This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Hello. Good to be talking to you this afternoon at 12:05. And on the Country Hour today, the federal government announces new safety regulations for quad bikes. We'll get to that just before 12:30 today. And China's African swine fever problems that's killed, well, nearly half of its pig population means that the country now has to find a new source of protein or other sources of protein. And it's really turning to sheep meats from Australia just to top up those protein supplies. That demand for sheep meats is causing a spike in the prices, something that WAMCO hasn't seen before. That's the WA Meat Marketing Company, the co-op based here in Western Australia, out of Katanning. And Cole McCrory will just go through what he's been seeing in this Chinese market really since the start of the year, when the demand and those prices really started to pick up. You'll hear from Cole McCrory after 12:30 today. And as you would have heard today, in an Australian first, a New South Wales farmer is set to launch legal action against global agrochemical company Monsanto, which makes the weed killer Roundup, containing the active ingredient glyphosate. Moama farmer Ross Wild will be represented by Tony Carbone from Carbone Lawyers, who will argue that Mr. Wild developed non-Hodgkin's lymphoma after exposure to Roundup. Tony Carbone, tell me about this farmer. When did he start using this product?
He does all sorts of farming, sheep. He's got also grain and stuff like that. Now, he has been using it for at least 40 years. He's got non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, the large B cells, and he's very, very sick. So that's why he's taken the company to court.
What exactly is he pursuing this legal action? What is the case based on?
Well, look, we've got medical evidence to say that exposure to the Roundup products, that is a reasonable degree of exposure. In his case, he was covered in Roundup. When he was spraying it, he was getting it all over his face and his body. His clothes were drenched in it quite often. And after being exposed to this product over many, many years, he's developed non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in recent times.
But doesn't that just prove that he wasn't using the product according to the safety directions, if he's getting it all over his body?
That's the problem. That's half the battle. The issue here is that Monsanto wanted to have freedom to trade. So effectively, they didn't give any proper instructions on usage on their bottles.
But who really goes about getting chemicals all over their body, being drenched in it anyway, well, regardless of the instructions?
Yeah, no, look, no one has that intention. The problem is you're spraying it, it's a mist, the wind blows, it goes over you. The company's always promoted the product as being safe. In fact, in some instances, they said it was safer than table salt. So the average person, including farmers and gardeners, including myself, would think that, okay, if it's marketed like that, well, it can't be unsafe, put it that way.
As far as you know, is this the first farmer in Australia to be taking legal action against Bayer?
That's my understanding.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it is.
So what does this farmer want?
Well, for starters, he wants everyone to know that the product isn't safe. He's been through a lot and he's going to go through quite a bit because he's getting a lot of treatment, and he wants the rest of the community to know that the product isn't safe. He basically wants to ensure that other people aren't in his situation. The Farmers Federation, as you said, aren't supportive, but at the end of the day, the evidence is mounting and it's stacking up heavily against Monsanto.
Well, the NFF, the National Farmers Federation, says the science and the advice from the chemical regulator, the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority, has confirmed that glyphosate, the active ingredient in Roundup, is safe. So the science is there to back up that position. How can you dispute the science?
Well, that's what they said in the States. The EPA supported that. But look what's happened in the States. In a lot of instances, when they did their testing, they did it on glyphosate technical, which is without all the adjuvants, that is the chemicals mixed in, and surfactants, which is what Monsanto do with their product. Now, they said that it was done on pure glyphosate and they say it's safe. But it depends on what studies you look at. There's been many, many studies over the years.
Well, the National Farmers Federation says there's been 40 years and 800 extensive studies, all of them showing that glyphosate is not carcinogenic and does not cause non-Hodgkin's lymphoma.
Have they produced any of those studies? That's the key to it. The studies that have been brought forward by Monsanto say that the product's safe. And you've heard what's happened over in the States. There's been issues about ghost riding and things like that. And there's been admissions by Monsanto scientists to say, yeah, they had a part to play in writing a lot of the articles and the science behind these products. And the fact of the matter is there's a whole lot of independent studies that have come back and said that enough exposure to the Roundup products will cause cancer. And in particular, the only cancer we're really dealing with is the non-Hodgkin's lymphomas, and just recently, the most recent studies showed that B-cell lymphomas are hard to discount after having significant exposure.
How did you, your firm, and the Moama farmer, Ross Wild, initially get together? Did he approach you or you approached him?
No, he approached me. I wouldn't know Mr. Wild until he came to me. He approached me after he saw the article on My Gardener. And after the article on The Gardener, we had a lot of people approach the firm. We've had many, many inquiries. I can't be exact on the numbers, but at one stage, I think we're hitting over 200.
Now, there are several cases in the United States. I think it's three at this point anyway.
There's been three decided cases. My understanding is there's up to 17,000 waiting to be dealt with.
But in those three cases, that the court has awarded billions of dollars in damages to the people who took legal action saying that glyphosate caused their cancers. All of those cases are going to be appealed by the company. How much do those cases in the United States indicate or reflect what might happen here in Australia with the people and the cases that you're pursuing?
Well, the science is the science. It doesn't matter if it's in Australia or in America or in Germany, France. Bottom line, the product is the product. So if these plaintiffs have succeeded in the States, there's no reason why the Australian plaintiff should be treated any differently. They were determined by juries, and after the juries heard all the evidence, and there's quite a bit of evidence because a lot of those cases went for more than 4 weeks, they came back and found in favour of the plaintiffs. So as far as I'm concerned, I don't see why there should be any difference in determination, in which, depending on what country you're in. As far as I'm concerned, the science is the science.
Did Ross Wild, the farmer taking this action, did he say to you that he was concerned about how other farmers might react to him pursuing legal action?
He said that he's disappointed that there hasn't been enough done to protect people like him, because if you have a look at the bottle, it does not explicitly say wear protective clothing, wear protective glasses, wear a mask. It doesn't say any of that.
Tony Carbone, he's the lawyer for New South Wales farmer Ross Wild, who's launching legal action against Monsanto, the global agrochemical company that's now owned by Bayer. And if Mr. Wild's name is familiar to you, he appeared on that 60 Minutes program looking at glyphosate. 14 past 12.
Have your say on the Country Hour. SMS the program on 0448 922 604.
Now, Bayer says it's aware of media reports regarding a statement of claim about glyphosate, but has not been served a writ at this time. Bayer says it has great sympathy for any individual with cancer, but the extensive body of science on glyphosate-based herbicides over four decades supports the conclusion that Roundup does not cause non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. There is more on the story if you'd like to read through it. An online story has just gone up in the last sort of hour or so, and the link to that is on the ABC Rural Facebook page, just to make it easier for you. Plenty of comments there, and I'd love to hear your thoughts too on the text, 0448 922 604. On the Facebook page, Tina says she thinks that things like fly spray, dishwashing liquid or cleaning products could have caused Mr. Wilde's health problems. She says, here's to using things way worse for us. Chemical prices going beyond what farmers can afford and food production going down. Councils still seem to use glyphosate a lot. He is 67. There is no proof that it causes cancer. And then others have commented saying there is proof that glyphosate caused his health problems. Be part of the conversation on Facebook if you like, or text through this afternoon. Well, despite the fact this New South Wales farmer is to launch this legal action against Monsanto, the federal government has ruled out any changes to the laws around the use of glyphosate. Federal Agriculture Minister Bridget McKenzie says the available science proves glyphosate is safe to use.
The reality is the APVMA, our independent regulator of chemical use in this country, has been very clear. It is safe to use glyphosate. And all the scientific rigour and the robustness reflects that decision. What we do know about glyphosate is when it's used in the manner in which the label dictates. I mean, that's the APVMA tells us how you can safely use these things. Gloves up to your elbows, goggles, etc. It is illegal to use glyphosate unless you use it according to the labelling instructions. And that's to keep people safe. That's a good thing. So we need to be trusting our scientific regulators. They use the very best science to make these decisions. And glyphosate's been determined safe to use in Australia. The World Health Organization's determined its safety. The United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization has determined it's safe to use. So the reality is we've got to not react to emotion or irrational arguments. We have to base our decisions on science, always. Glyphosate has seen a reduction in chemical use on farms. It's seen the introduction and the use of no tilling on farms, which has been great outcomes for the environment. So the APVMA is the institution tasked with regulating our chemical environment and the way we use chemicals in Australia. It's determined it's safe. Use it according to the label, and I'm confident that that is the appropriate regime for Australia to be adopting.
You say that it's safe and the science from the APVMA has said it's safe, but then there are still countries like France that don't want it to be used in countries like that. Where does that come from? How does that fit?
I had that exact discussion in Italy and Brussels when I was over there at the Food and Agricultural Organization, the FAO, which really is an organisation set up after the Second World War. Australia actually was an instigator of this, to feed the world, to make sure all countries, all citizens of the world have access to safe, nutritious, affordable food. Now, the appropriate use of chemicals and systems have been fundamental in ensuring that can happen, that drought-ravaged countries in Africa can actually grow food. The EU, in particular countries like France, have changed the way they assess things, and rather than basing it on risk, basing it on science, have chosen another way to assess it. The world doesn't do it that way. The world chooses to use science. Australia chooses to use science and will continue to do so.
There are countless people who have come out to speak about their experience with glyphosate and their sicknesses following that. What would you say to someone who has been suffering with a sickness and is strongly believes that it has been caused by the use of glyphosate?
Well, anybody who develops those sort of illnesses, you know, my heart goes out to them. It's not easy to go through these sort of things. I couldn't make any comment on attributing causality for anyone's illness, only to say that all the scientific evidence that the APVMA has assessed, not just that we've done here in Australia, but that's been examined across the world, points to a well-regulated, use safely chemical that can actually help us grow clean green product and have great environmental outcomes.
Do you think this will be the first of many lawsuits against Bayer when it comes to glyphosate?
I couldn't really comment on where this will lead. I can only comment on my commitment, my government's commitment, to using science to make decisions.
Bridget McKenzie, the Federal Agriculture Minister, with Michelle Stanley. 20 past 12. Well, President of the Pastoralists and Graziers Association agrees with the Minister, saying the science around glyphosate is crystal clear. It is not a dangerous product if used correctly. Tony Seabrook says the farmer's decision to pursue Monsanto in the courts, claiming his exposure to glyphosate was the reason he developed non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, just doesn't have merit. He says the product is a vital tool for modern broadacre farming.
The crop we grow in Australia today in a drying climate needs to go into the ground as quickly as possible with the absolute minimum disturbance, otherwise you start losing moisture. The West Australian crop now is in the condition it's in, and it's under drought stress, so there's no doubt about that. But it is as good as it is because it went in as early as we could and with all the moisture conservation possible. And glyphosate is the only chemical that will allow us to take out the sorts of weeds that we need to do that. There's a secondary one which is nowhere near as good. It's spray seed. It's made of two components. It is a nasty chemical.
Do you think the mere act of lodging a claim like this and the other claims that have been lodged and successfully prosecuted in the US and other places gives some farmers pause for thought about whether they should be using glyphosate?
There will be a few. There always are. Most of us are very scientific in the way that we use these products. We're very careful. We take all the care in the world. We don't expose ourselves any more than we need to, not because it's dangerous, but because that's good husbandry. That's because that's what you should do. We use the minimal amount that we can. We don't waste it. We don't throw it around when we don't need to. Almost the entire cropping system in West Australia, Australia, and perhaps a large part of the world is built around being able to kill weeds with a herbicide rather than try and bash them to death with cultivation. And with that simple statement of bashing them to death with cultivation, that means bashing our soil structure to pieces. It means erosion, wind and water. The downside to not being able to continue farming the way we're farming, it doesn't bear thinking about.
Just in plain words, how important is glyphosate to the industry, and what would be the, do you think, the consequence if it was limited or even banned as a result of cases like this?
Well, you know, I've been around in this business for a long time, and I was farming before glyphosate came on the scene. Today, with a good seeding machine and a boom spray, you can grow successfully a crop in a very dry climate. Prior to glyphosate becoming available, we had to wait for a rain that was good enough to actually be able to till the soil. We don't now. We can get in with less than that, but we'd have to wait for that rain. We'd have to till the soil. Then we'd have to wait for the weeds to come up. Then we'd have to kill them with a cultivator, which is another tillage equipment, maybe twice. And then we'd have to sow it with another machine that would probably kill weeds at the same time. The soil was so smashed up by the time we'd finished that process that a big wetting event or a big wind would take it away. You know, you'd see dust storms, you'd see rivers running brown. This chemical is absolutely crucial to farming the way we farm today, and there aren't any alternatives.
How much interest do you think farmers will be taking in this case in Australia?
Look, I think a huge amount. Be a large portion, though, of the farming community that would hold the view that this is so utterly ridiculous that it should be thrown out of court. And that's this sort of, I don't even want to countenance the stupidity that would evolve around a successful challenge as this chap is possibly pursuing. It beggars belief that this particular chemical, and we use hundreds of them, that this particular chemical is the one that's under challenge.
Pastoralists and Graziers Association President Tony Seabrook with Daniel Mercer. And a lot of you want to have your say on this. You can do that on the Facebook page, ABC Rural Facebook page. The text is 0448 922 604, talking about the fact that this farmer from New South Wales, from Moama, Ross Wild is his name, is going to be taking legal action against Monsanto. And the argument from his lawyer, who you heard from earlier, Tony Carbone, is that it's based on the way Monsanto for many years has marketed Roundup, which contains the chemical glyphosate. For example, the lack of appropriate warnings on that is the argument. On Facebook, Neil says, is this bandwagon litigation? From Kerry, if it's not used properly in the right dose, anything can kill you. The warnings on the containers are not considered. And Leonie, his client's body and clothes had been drenched in the herbicide. You simply cannot protect people from their own stupidity. It's a bit like suing the makers of a road that has a 60 kilometres per hour speed limit on it because you had a serious accident while doing 120 kilometres an hour. On the text too, quite a few to get through here. Salty Matt says, I guess until you're the person with terminal non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, it's pretty easy to sit back and say how safe Roundup is. Perhaps it is carcinogenic. I would rather not have to die to find out. From Sebastian, the lawyer didn't answer your question. Why would one drench themselves regardless of the label? Unfortunately, stupid people who haven't taken responsibility and use common sense are leading to populist hysteria that starts to prevent farmers and land managers from using essential tools in weed control. The alternatives can be more harmful, expensive, but average silly city dwellers have no idea. Mike from Bridgetown says, Bridget McKenzie's proving to be the best agriculture minister this country has had for a long time. Knowledgeable and articulate. Thanks to Nick from Kojanup. He's just sent the, I haven't enlarged the photo, but it looks like a photo of Roundup with all the instructions on the back. He says, please read the safety directions. It's a label from a drum of Roundup. Thank you for that, Nick. Be part of the conversation too. 0448 922 604. Plenty of comments coming in. I'll get to those shortly. We'll get to news headlines too and across to the Bureau of Meteorology just around about 12:30 today. Before that though, as I mentioned earlier, all new quad bikes in Australia must be fitted with operator protection devices or roll bars. After a two-year phase-in, the government has announced new regulations this morning after years of lobbying by farmers and doctors to improve safety. And the feds aren't stopping at that. The government is now calling on the states to ban kids from riding quad bikes. National Rural reporter Kath Sullivan has the details.
Just last weekend, the Victorian coroner was called upon to investigate the death of a three-year-old in a quad bike accident in that state's east. Since 2011, on average, 16 people a year are killed in quad bike accidents, and an estimated 6 people a day present at emergency hospital departments after coming off quad bikes. Today, the federal government has announced that after a two-year phase-in, all new quad bikes must be fitted with an operator protection device or roll bar. They'll also be required to meet minimum stability requirements.
We believe that this change will help save lives and reduce the risk of serious injuries with respect to quad bike rollovers.
That's the Assistant Treasurer Michael Sucker announcing the changes in Melbourne this morning. He's also announced some more pressing changes to regulations, which will mandate that after a one-year phase-in, all new quad bikes in Australia must be issued with a warning that alerts riders to the risk of rollovers. He's also said that after 1 year, all new quad bikes must meet US or European standards on components like brakes, suspension, throttle and clutch. All of the changes announced today apply to new bikes and won't affect those that are already on Australian farms. It comes after competition watchdog the ACCC made recommendations for increased quad bike safety in March of last year. Here's its spokesman, Mick Keogh, responding to this morning's government announcement.
The tragic deaths and injuries that occur from these seductively simple to ride vehicles frequently cause severe trauma and distress in regional communities and amongst families. And we believe the measures that have been announced by the Minister today will go a long way towards reducing these fatalities and injuries and making these vehicles much safer.
Assistant Treasurer Michael Sucker said he'll be calling on the states and territories to do more to stop quad bike accidents.
We will be writing to them with a range of additional recommendations that in the end will be within their remit. That includes mandating the use of helmets, prohibiting passengers on single-use quad bikes, and also prohibiting children using adult quad bikes. In the end, the particular state or territory jurisdictions will have to determine those matters themselves, including particularly the recommendation around children.
Today's announcement flies in the face of manufacturers' threats to withdraw from the Australian market if rollover protections are mandated. The National Farmers Federation, unions, Country Women's Association and Rural Doctors Association have been lobbying heavily for the changes and will no doubt see today's announcement as a big win.
Kath Sullivan with that report. There is more online. There's a link to the story on the ABC Rural Facebook page. Plenty of comments there too. Ian says, the basic design of quad bikes is flawed, with the wheel base being too narrow and a high centre of gravity. Putting more weight higher up is not helpful, especially if there is no restraint system fitted. From Martin, still maintain it's the rider, not the machine, that's at fault. And owing to the fact that stupid is sometimes a terminal illness, these things will not make that big of a difference. And this from Teresa. Quads have had safety warning signs on them for 30 years. Putting extra ones on will not change a single thing. This is the Country Hour. It's 12:30. Ali Colvin is in the studio with the news headlines.
Thanks, Belinda. The Home Affairs Minister says Australia would be at risk of a mass casualty terrorist attack if the federal government rescues the families of Islamic State fighters who remain in Syria. Dozens of women and children are living in refugee camps after their husbands were killed or jailed after fighting alongside IS. Family members in Australia have been pleading for their return, arguing they pose no threat to the country. The Labor frontbencher Tanya Plibersek says she disagrees with a call from within her party to reduce its climate change targets. Resources spokesman Joel Fitzgibbon says the opposition confused and scared voters at the May election and should adopt the coalition's target of a 28% emissions cut by 2030. The Mayor of Mandurah has appealed to the state government to help fund a list of recommendations to address its growing homelessness and crime problems. It includes the rollout of a program which pairs mental health workers with police officers to respond to such issues and increasing drug rehabilitation services. Thanks, Belinda. There'll be more news at 1.
Ali, thank you so much for that. It is 28 to 1.
The WA Country Hour with Belinda Barischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Just going through some more of your thoughts on the news today that a New South Wales farmer is, he hasn't quite handed in the writ yet. My understanding is that's going to happen today. That's what the lawyer was telling me earlier. But in the meantime, this farmer intends to sue Monsanto, saying that, you know, his use of Roundup, which contains glyphosate, that's the active ingredient, has caused his non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. On the text, you can get non-Hodgkin's lymphoma from diesel fumes. What's to say the plaintiff didn't get the disease from diesel fumes? If the plaintiff wants to get the message out there, as Mr. Carbone says, then he doesn't need a multi-million dollar claim to do that. Lawyers are going to cripple our country with claims such as this. From Sebastian, that's the name you use when you don't want to use your name. A glyphosate is fine for knockdown spraying, but desiccating crops with it for harvest should be stopped immediately. We don't need to be ingesting it. Belinda, from the glyphosate label under safety directions, that's from Will. And we're getting a lot of these photos just about the safety instructions. Damon sent one through too. Saying no mention of protective clothing and gloves on the label when it is there now. But a lot of these cases, and if you look back at the ones in the United States, it's that historical message and that historical labelling that's been on the product that is really going to form the centre of this argument, is my understanding of it, if it's what's been going on in the US is anything to go by. This from Paul. Has Bridget McKenzie got a twin? We need a pro-farmer minister in the WA government. Be part of it. 0448 922 604. And shortly on the Country Hour, we're going to be talking about the demand for sheep meat products coming from China, catching up with the CEO of Wamco, the sheep meat processor based out of Katanning, just saying that that demand is huge at the moment, and the prices going into China since the start of the year have been incredible. In fact, Cole McCrory, the CEO, hasn't seen anything like it in his time. You'll hear more from Cole McCrory shortly on the Country Hour. Right now, it's off to the Weather Bureau and Stephen McInerney with you this afternoon. Stephen, let's have a look at northern and eastern parts.
Yeah, good afternoon. I guess what we're seeing actually today is pretty clear conditions. So we've got a really weak front approaching the southwest of the state. So that's only really going to start affecting that far southwest corner, I guess, later on today. So further north and further east, it's really just going to be fine and clear, certainly for the next day or so. On Saturday, though, we might start seeing a little bit of shower and thunderstorm activity sort of developing through the, I suppose, the Goldfields, the Euclid District, even eastern parts of the Southwest Land Division. Not much in the way of rainfall, though, expected. Most of that will be probably more confined to the southeast coastal areas during Saturday itself. And then those conditions sort of slowly contract eastwards as we go during Sunday. So by Monday, most of the weather is actually really confined back towards the southwest of the state. So we are expecting, again, some quite hot temperatures up through, I guess, the north and the east over the weekend as well. Some pretty severe to extreme fire dangers probably for the interior district, certainly on Saturday. So it looks to be that that day is potentially the windiest and certainly the warmest temperatures for eastern parts of the state. But yeah, as I said, I mean, no real sign of thunderstorms over the next few days. So there had been, over the last week or so, some very isolated activity up in the northern Kimberley. But with these easterly winds up through northern parts, that's all been sort of curtailed, certainly for the next 4 days or so.
Let's move into the Southwest Land Division. What can you see?
Yeah, so with that front approaching, we probably aren't expecting too much in the way of rainfall for the southwest tonight, but it will sort of slowly work its way through southwestern parts as we go during tomorrow. So it will sort of reach areas southwest of the line, say from Durian Bay down towards Hopetown. There is a chance that you might see rainfall totals in the 2 to 10, maybe even up to 15 mil ranges through areas, I guess, sort of stretching from, say, Mandurah down towards Bremer Bay and that kind of zone. So it does look like it's not quite the southwest or far southwest corner this time. It's more sort of stretched in through parts of the Great Southern as well as the south coastal district for the rainfall tomorrow. And then, I guess, conditions will slowly contract eastwards as we go during Saturday. So those lingering showers are more for the northern and eastern parts of the Southwest Land Division. You could see falls 5 to 15 mils really for eastern areas, say for the Great Southern Central Wheat Belt, also through that southeast coastal district. So that Esperance Hopetown region could see, you know, somewhere in around, well, I suppose the range of 5 to 15. That will also sort of work its way into the southern parts of the Goldfields during the day. And then on, I guess, on Sunday, Monday, it's really just back to onshore flow in the southern part. So we do have another ridge developing in the south, so really it's just going to be more confined to the far southwestern parts of the Southwest Land Division, and really that will continue on Monday with really another, I suppose, ridge developing over the south of the state, so most of the showers will be just along that south coast.
And to recap the warnings for this afternoon then, Stephen.
Yeah, so the warnings, we do have a fairly broad area of fire weather warnings. So those include the Interior District, the West Kimberley Coast, Kimberley Inland, the West Pilbara Coast, Ashburton Inland, Goldfields Euclid, and then also eastern parts of the Southwest Land Division. So that's continuing today, probably a little bit less tomorrow, but again, for the northern and eastern parts, the fire dangers will continue over the next 4 days.
Good. Thank you for the wrap. Appreciate that. 22 to 1. On the rainfall, there's been none over 5 millimetres anywhere across Western Australia. That's in the last 24 hours to 9 o'clock this morning.
On ABC Radio WA, you're with Belinda Barischetti for the WA Country Hour.
Some more of your thoughts on the text 0448922604. This from Les at Gero. G'day, Belinda. Quad bikes, round up. You will never prevent stupidity. And this from another Sebastian. People don't understand that glyphosate is the same carcinogen category as red wine, red meat, and burnt toast. I wonder which one punters consume the most of. Be part of the conversation on the text today, 0448 922 604. We'll get to Mount Barker for the results of the cattle market just before the news at 1 o'clock. But first up, export sheep meat prices are going through the roof as China scrambles to secure enough protein to replace domestic pork supplies that have been decimated by African swine fever. Cole McCreary is the group CEO of meat processor Wamco, that's the WA Meat Marketing Cooperative, and Southern Meats, based in Goulburn in New South Wales. He says he's never seen anything like this. A year ago, export mutton to China was fetching around $7 a kilogram, and today it's around $8.50 a kilogram. Even some lamb prices have gone up $2 to $3 a kilo. It's all being driven by the rapid spread of the pig killing disease, which is predicted to wipe out 20% of world meat protein by the end of the year. Cole McCreary, what have you been seeing in this Chinese market?
We've seen more and more demand and a willingness from the Chinese to pay more for the sort of secondary cuts in particular, but also even extending into some of our more primal cuts. And it's just a factor of a lack of protein that's in the market over there at the moment.
When did you see this sort of changing, the demand lifting or the prices, the price they're prepared to pay lifting?
Probably gained momentum from the start of this calendar year. And now is certainly at an all-time high. We've never seen prices to this extent.
Can you give us an example then, just so we're really clear of the sort of price increases that you've seen since, say, the start of this year, with a few examples of, say, mutton and some of those other cuts you've been talking about? Maybe looking back a year ago at what they were worth and what China's prepared to pay now.
Well, we've seen price increases of $1, $1.50 a kilo on mutton six ways. Some of the flat prices on lambs, as you've seen, sort of in the vicinity of $2 and $3 a kilo increases. So that's fairly decent increases that are really supporting the farming fraternity, and it's been passed back to the farmers because some of the pricing for this current spring is at all time highs, which is fantastic.
So have you ever seen a price rise like that in, say, well, just under a year, if it all sort of started earlier this year? Can you think of a time where it's risen by that much?
Not really, not on secondary cuts. You know, you might occasionally see decent lifts on some of the top line cuts like your racks and your loins and things of that nature, but certainly not on secondary frozen cuts into a market like China. We wouldn't have seen the drastic increases that we have seen.
And was this something that Wamco was expecting, you know, when you sort of started keeping an eye on what's going on in China with African swine fever and monitoring the spread? Did you anticipate this sort of demand?
Probably not to this degree. We knew there'd be a price increases, but probably just the severity of the numbers of pigs they've had to slaughter over there because of the swine flu. We probably didn't envisage it as being as great as it has been. Yeah.
And this might be a little harder to tell, but is it just the sheep meats that China is demanding, or have you?
No, we're seeing obviously we're not a beef processor, but I know a number of beef processors have seen significant increases in prices in China as well. And I think it's just that generally a lift for all primary proteins that are going into that market at the moment.
Now, obviously, you've got the meatworks here in Western Australia at Katanning. You've also got Southern Meats over in Goulburn in the eastern states. So how are you sort of filling the orders, a little bit from each, or how does that work?
We've basically, in volume, we're probably not sending a huge, great deal more because we haven't gone and killed a whole lot more. But what we are doing is getting greater value for what we are sending. So we've seen small lifts, particularly out of Wamco, but it's, obviously there's a limit to what level of offcuts you do get. So all we're really seeing is a big lift in our revenue, which is great.
What about other countries then, Cole McCreary? Have you seen other demand rising as sort of this African swine fever spreads through other parts of Asia?
A little bit, but not so much and not as significant as China. We've certainly seen other countries having to, if they want to try and acquire the cuts that the Chinese are taking, they've sort of had to lift their levels. But they're struggling to meet paying the levels that the Chinese are paying for that particular product. Outside China, they're finding it very hard to compete.
I see. Well, how long is this set to continue, do you think?
They're saying it could take years to rebuild anywhere near where they were. You're talking, you know, I've heard figures of 7, 8, 9 years. So just it's obviously pretty tough for the pork industry over and domestically in China, but it's obviously fairly good news for processors in Australia and New Zealand and other countries that supply. And then I think it's good news for farmers that are, that have stuck with the industry and are working hard to supply.
So, I mean, this must be just a great opportunity, really, as, you know, the demand for the sheep meat going into China increases and they're prepared to pay for it too. And eventually, once the situation with African swine fever is sorted out and they're back on track with the pork production in the country, I mean, are you using this as a window of opportunity that they might just sort of capture some of that market for forever?
Yeah, possibly, but the big thing is that the New Zealand and Australian sheep flocks are not increasing at all. So what it basically means is that you're robbing Peter to pay Paul. So a lot of other markets are missing out. One in particular is the EU market. That, you know, New Zealand has a big opportunity there. They're not sending anywhere near as much product to that market as they have been in the past years. And China are soaking up all that spare capacity. So, yeah, I think there is a window there, but I think with the flocks not getting any bigger, I think that we're going to be able to hold very good value going forward in the years ahead. So it's a good time to be in sheep.
Mm. How do you plan for that sort of over those years with that demand, as you said earlier, I think sort of going out to 7, 9 years or something?
Yeah, well, everyone will be trying to manage their market mix and obviously probably transferring product from other markets to that Chinese market. So that they can optimise their revenues and obviously their business model. So, yeah, I guess it's about managing what you're processing and what you're prepared to send outside, away from China. It's pretty limited on those type of middle cuts and off cuts. And generally, I think that most people would be focused on trying to send as much of that product to China as they could.
Cole, really good to catch up with you on the Country Hour today. Appreciate your time.
No problem. Thank you.
Cole McCrory, he is the Group CEO of Wamco and Southern Meats over in Goulburn in New South Wales. He's talking about that incredible demand, well, the incredible prices that China is prepared to pay just to get enough protein to replace all those domestic pork supplies that have been sort of eaten away by that African swine fever that's taken hold of the domestic pig population. This is the Country Hour. It's 12 to 1. And still on the topic of African swine fever, you can rest easy. Australia has no reason to be concerned about the disease coming into Australia. And that's because Suki has arrived in Darwin. Now, Suki is one of Australia's best sniffer dogs. And she got to work yesterday trying to sniff out pork products from overseas that could possibly be carrying this devastating African swine fever. Not sure how one sniffer dog will cope with the burden of keeping Australia free of the disease that's causing millions of dollars worth of damage to pork industries across Asia and other parts of the globe, though. But when Michelle Stanley caught up with the Federal Agriculture Minister Bridget McKenzie in Carnarvon yesterday, she stressed the government is taking biosecurity seriously.
Yeah, well, my message is biosecurity is everyone's business. And I heard that today in Carnarvon as well. You know, local growers concerned that even backpackers or transport operators not understanding that it's transported in soil. So wash your boots, make sure you're not going onto infected farms and non-infected farms and being part of the problem. So biosecurity is everybody's problem. It's also that the risk is very, very real. And right now, following the announcement by Timor-Leste that they have African swine fever, it's, 650-odd Ks off of our coast. So as a government, we've banned the importation of pork products from affected nations. We've increased the screening of people people and parcels, because that's typically the pathway this disease will travel in. And in that time, we've uncovered 27 tonne of cooked pork products, which is incredibly disturbing. We've also upped the regime of fines and infringements and penalties. We can send people home. If you are going to be bringing these products into this country and potentially decimating our pork industry, which employs over 34,000 Australians, we've got 2,700 pork producers across the country, if you're going to be potentially decimating that industry, then you do not deserve to come on your holiday. You don't deserve to see your son or your daughter who might be an international student studying in Sydney or Melbourne. You do not deserve the privilege of travelling and working and residing in our nation. So I'm taking a very tough stance. I know my border security officers, my biosecurity officers are equally taking a tough stance. And as a government, we're doing everything we can to make sure that we stop African swine fever at the border. We've sent Suki, one of our most experienced detector dogs, to Darwin. Her first day on the job was today in Darwin. And she's been one of our best sniffer dogs. So she's sniffing pork product as we speak with the 9 direct flights from Timor-Leste to Darwin. And at every airport, we're doing everything we can. Obviously, our state governments also have a role to play in making sure that they're ready to go and our pork producers are taking this very, very seriously. But one of the main risks is it's transported in soil, right? So you may not have been on a pig farm in an affected country, but you might have taken that beautiful hike in the wilderness. Please clean your boots. It's a little thing, but it could save an entire industry. So everyone needs to take it seriously. Everyone needs to take responsibility. Every Australian needs to take responsibility to keep our biosecurity borders safe.
Bridget McKenzie, the Federal Agriculture Minister, talking to Michelle Stanley. And I'm told that it's been decades since a Federal Agriculture Minister visited the Gascoyne region. 13 to 1.
You're with Belinda Barischetti for the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
The WA Fishing Industry Council thinks it's time to kiss and make up with the state government. More specifically, WAFIC's trying to improve communications between our commercial rock lobster industry and the state's fisheries minister. And the reason? Well, you might remember last week that the fisheries minister, Dave Kelly, announced they were increasing crayfish catch limits for the charter fishing industry. And the Western Rock Lobster Council wasn't very happy, saying that they weren't consulted. So WAFIC's CEO, Alex Ogg, thinks it would be a good idea to create a cross-industry government roundtable to improve the strained relations.
I think it's fair to say that no one likes surprises. And the Minister's announcement regarding these changes to the rules for the charter catch and cook sector last Friday caught us completely off guard. And Joe, you can appreciate when industry learns of these type of decisions in that fashion and people are acting on limited information drawn from a media release, it's natural people jump to assumptions and often assume the worst, particularly on the back of an already unsteady relationship. So just the essence of what was announced with no commercial fishing conversation in advance can spark controversy in a way that may well have been avoided if a different tact had been taken.
The Western Rock Lobster Council has said that it was disappointed with the lack of consultation and that it has concerns in a number of areas. Was WAFIC consulted at all? Did you have any idea that this rule changes were coming?
To be fair, the Minister's office tried to contact me the morning that the media release was going out. I was out bush and missed that call and learned about it retrospectively.
So do you think this reflects that breakdown in the relationship that it appears has occurred between Dave Kelly and the lobster fishing industry post those failed attempts to change quota that we saw?
I think there has been a level of degradation of trust between industry and government over the past 12 months, and that's now leading to a hesitancy, to be fair, probably a hesitancy from both camps, to engage in productive discussions and to take these collaborative approaches towards future initiatives.
How do you do that? How do you repair some of that trust?
What we've done on the back of this is something we've been contemplating for some time. We've called for the Minister and the Department to look at a cross-industry government roundtable to address really the elephant in the room. We'd like to include participation with the recreational sector and also the hospitality and tourism sectors. And those are the people that government and ourselves really need to be co-planning with in terms of our growth as an industry and how we can complement and support those industries and vice versa.
Will WAFIC lead that, Alex, that cross-industry roundtable, or are you...
Listen, it's still in the formation phase. I've had good discussions with our chair, Ron Edwards, over the past week. It's something we've just introduced to government. We're sort of waiting to have the preliminary discussions about how that's going to pan out.
Is it something that government is receptive to, or are you yet to hear on that as well?
Well, it is, but the discussions are still in early stages.
That's WAFIC CEO Alex Ogg catching up with Joe Prendergast. 1:05.
Join us for The World Today.
Hello, I'm Thomas Ariti. On the program today, confusing statements from the US president as Turkey invades northern Syria. We'll have the latest. Also today, the Prime Minister appoints a celebrity as Australia's first national careers ambassador. And bureaucracy, a lack of investment and poor collaboration. Community leaders in northern Australia call for action.
I'm sure that when the Northern Australia White Paper was released, everyone in Northern Australia, you know, they were all so excited and thought, right, things are finally going to start happening. But there's been a great lack of action with developing Northern Australia.
More than the headlines, The World Today.
1:04 on the country hour, and time to get to the markets now, the results of the Mount Barker cattle market, and Tracy Kilner has those details. Tracy, how was the market today? What were the numbers like?
Numbers were down for a total yarding of 899 good quality cattle. Prices rose for the prime quality stock, with the medium weight yearling steers topping the market at 342 cents, closely followed by heavyweight weaner steers at 340 cents a kilo. The heavy prime cow sold to a top of 228, with the store cow market very strong, selling to a top of 216 cents. Prime heavy bulls eased, topping at 222 cents a kilo. The bullocks weighing over 600 kilos sold for 264 to 268 cents. Ground steers weighing between 5 and 600 kilos made from 240 to 280 cents, while the lighter 400 to 500 kilo grown steers sold for 240 to 276 cents to average 261 cents a kilo. Heifers over 540 kilos gained 30 cents on quality and demand, selling for 235 to 250 cents, while the lighter weight grown heifers made from 248 to 284 cents a kilo. Yearling steers sold from 208 to 342 cents for the best, averaging 308 cents a kilo. Yearling heifers made from 200 to 294 cents to average 261 cents a kilo. Weaner steers sold for 232 to 340 cents to average 311 cents, while the weaner heifers returned 212 to 276 cents to average 236 cents a kilo. Heavy prime cows gained, selling from 190 to 228 cents, averaging 210 cents a kilo. Medium weight cows made from 192 to 212 cents to average 204 cents. Boners sold for 100 to 200 cents, depending on quality, to average 174 cents a kilo, while store cows are in demand, selling from 198 to 216 cents a kilo. The prime heavy bulls eased 9 cents, making from 150 to 222 cents, to average 205 cents. Medium weight bulls sold for 158 to 204 cents, and the lightweight bullies sold from 218 to 288 cents. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Tracy, thanks for going through those details. And that wraps up the livestock markets for this week. We'll check the wool market details this time tomorrow. Just a few moments ago, talking about how the WA Fishing Industry Council thinks that now is the time to sort of kiss and make up with the state government after some rocky patches along the way between the council, the industry, and the fisheries minister of the state government. This story from Rod in the truck. Bell, the rock lobster fishing industry are whinging again. This government is trying to free up our resource so others can enjoy our awesome lobsters, typical of those that feel they are entitled. And plenty to say on the top story today, talking to you about how an Australian first, a New South Wales farmer, is set to launch legal action against Monsanto, which makes the weed killer Roundup, which contains that active ingredient glyphosate. This Moama farmer, Ross Wild, says his exposure to Roundup has given him non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and that writ should be served to Monsanto today. A few comments through on that. On the Facebook page, petrol is carcinogenic, says Owen. Catherine says, I was soaked in this stuff when the backpack failed. I was spraying weeds at school. I thought it was sweat. I wore it all day. I was using it to bare minimum, and I noticed it extremely hard to get anything to grow where it was used consistently. With Monsanto's record, I have no doubt they've been bodging research and paying off people for years. I wish that farmer luck in recovering and a successful case. To add, despite the world food regulators allowing a certain percent in our food. 1 o'clock.